This is the second part of the interview with Ingo Weber, where we talk about his projects involving blockchain technology and discuss recommendations on how to understand if this technology fits any project. Listen to the first part for introduction to Ingo's work and introduction to blockchain technology. This is Anton Yeshenko and you're listening to A Side of Data, a podcast about unconventional side of data science. Let's more go from general explanations to something very specific. Maybe you can we can talk about some use cases that exactly you worked with.
Right, so you already mentioned in the introduction that startup company Lava. So they use a specific kind of labeling mechanism on goods that is very hard to reproduce through to counterfeit, and that can be used on all kinds of things, from designer handbags to medicine, to vitamins, nutritional supplements, milk powder, what have you, and can prevent counterfeiting through that. And then of course you can link the identity of a particular physical good to the data that's on blockchain, and that stores where this item is in the world.
Okay, so this company developed some system for delivery of goods or for moving goods, or more specific?
So think about a much more sophisticated version of a QR code that can be printed on things, so it's actually reasonably cheap to update production lines, to individually print these tags on goods, so that you don't, at the moment, if you look at the anything you buy in the supermarket, it has a QR, it has a barcode at the back, and that's not an identifier of this particular.
Just on the line.
Exactly, it's about the product. And if instead you can identify each particular, you know, tub of hand lotion, for example, or each particular drinking bottle, then you can use that to detect counterfeiting much easier, because you can say it's very very unlikely that this tub has been in Asia yesterday and today it's in the supermarket in Germany. And so it's much more likely that there's a counterfeit version of that particular product floating around somewhere in Asia.
Okay, so they have just smart labels or label. Unique label for each instance of the product.
Yes.
And where is the blockchain coming?
The blockchain is then used for storing the data in the backend on the movement of these goods. When was it produced? When was it shipped? Where was it shipped? Where was it scanned individually on the way? And then even you can have particular scans that make you realize when it has been opened. When has this bottle of vitamins been opened? And you know, if you see that same bottle of vitamins somewhere else on the shelf, then maybe somebody unsold the used bottle, the empty bottle. There is actually a market for used vitamin bottles and all of that kind of stuff in certain geographic areas, where people can sell them for, you know, decent money. And that is then used for counterfeiting.
And what's the, what was the challenge? What exactly about the blockchain?
Yes, so supply chain by now is one of the standard cases, of course. But linking it, so the challenges, there were a few challenges at the time when we did it, when we started working on the project. Among others, you know, addressing the specific requirements of that company in terms of scalability and in terms of cost, etc. We actually wrote a paper that was published at the ICSA conference earlier this year, in March 2019, on building a multi-tenant solution. Mm-hmm. So, for example, this company Lava, right, has customers which is similar to a cloud provider who has different tenants who are all using the same infrastructure. And now in the case of Lava, the company, the infrastructure is their blockchain-based platform. And then you have, for example, somebody who produces millions of bottles of drinks every day. And you have somebody else who produces a few designer handbags every day. And you have somebody else running supply chain tracking for their medicine on the same platform. Now, you don't want these individual tenants to influence each other in the sense of confidentiality. You want isolation so that one cannot read the other's data. Performance isolation, very important, because the throughput of the blockchain-based systems is limited. You also want to have manageable cost. And so we designed a solution that would use a separate permission blockchain for each tenant and would bundle all of the information, the integrity information, into a single code that would then be written onto a public blockchain.
Ah, okay. So there is an interplay between like blockchain that is stored in a, like in a company and the real Ethereum blockchain.
The public Ethereum blockchain or, you know, any other one. And the beauty of it is the information that we store on the public Ethereum blockchain or some other public blockchain is very small and it is static in size. Right? Regardless whether the company has 100 tenants or just one, the size of the information for which we need to pay quite a bit to store on a public blockchain always remains stable in size, static.
I also read that recently there was a transaction in Bitcoin that was 1 billion euros transferred.
Oh, yes.
So that's something, yeah, that you still pay one little price for any transaction. So you...
Yes, yeah, the transaction fee in these networks is dependent on the in the public blockchain networks is dependent on the size and complexity of the transaction, not on the value being transferred. So you don't lose a percentage of your transfer, you just lose a constant amount, or it's not that constant, it depends on the network, the congestion of the network, etc. But yeah, whether you transfer $10 on Bitcoin and you spend $5 on transaction fee, or you transfer $1 billion on Bitcoin and spend $5 on transaction fees, that doesn't matter for the fee, it matters for you.
Yeah, I tried once to transfer and I transferred basically like 1 euro in Bitcoin and it cost me 1 euro, so...
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And any other use cases?
The other one you mentioned in the introduction already that I'm quite excited about is the one where we used blockchain as a backend for a system to administer the National Disability Insurance Scheme of Australia. So the scheme where the government gives budgets to disabled people to support them, you know, buying expensive medical equipment, power scooters, wheelchairs, renovating probably their homes, etc. Getting physiotherapy and what have you. And this is a conditional payment system, meaning the government doesn't just give you $10,000 for the year and say, spend it on what you need it for. They say, here's $2,000 for a power scooter, and you're gonna need a new power scooter. And here is another $6,000 for physiotherapy, etc., etc. So it's tied to specific conditions in the sense of you can only spend it on what your treatment plan says, and you can only spend it depending on the category of what you have. For example, treatment, you can only spend the money you have for physiotherapy treatment at accredited physiotherapists, for example.
Mm.
Such a conditional payment system can be innovated through the concept of programmable money, where you essentially take a little bundle of money and you attach conditions directly to it. And now the money essentially knows the conditions, which of course in the case of blockchain are encoded in smart contracts. And when you try to spend that money, the conditions are automatically checked. So if you go to a bottle shop and you try to buy a nice bottle of Australian wine instead of a power scooter, then the money will say, no, you cannot actually spend me on that.
But how was it in real implemented? Because they still use Australian dollars.
How is it implemented today?
I mean, because I actually read some description and there was, you did it and people actually used it. So
we had an evaluation with actual participants of the NDIS scheme, so disabled people and carers from their family, etc. And they used the system in the form of a scientific evaluation. Mm-hmm. We did have a nice user interface developed on top of it, a nice mobile app where they then could say, oh, I want to go to a physiotherapy session. They could find through the interface a physiotherapist,
uh-huh,
and then book an appointment with that physiotherapist and put money aside, for example, for treatment for the next 10 months, etc. So, and then they could do simple transactions like a one-off purchase with a participating merchant, like that power scooter example. And of course the user interface already understands what is allowed and what isn't allowed.
Okay, now I understand that basically you have an app that will introduce you to supported parties that you can purchase from.
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
That's it.
But if you somehow went around the front end and went directly to the back end to try and spend the money, you still couldn't, because the money itself checks whether it can be spent for what you're trying to do right now.
Okay.
And so this together, the user interface and the blockchain backend and the concept of programmable money was perceived to be of great advantage by the NDIS participants that were part of our evaluation, part of our study.
Understood. And I guess one of the concluded questions, how to build the systems, what components you need and how in general describe the architecture of the system.
Well, this is basically the topic of our book, right? Architecture for Blockchain Applications, that was published earlier this year. And so essentially you need to understand what blockchain is good for in terms of the functions it can support in an architecture, and in terms of the non-functional properties like integrity, etc. So in terms of the functions it can support, blockchain as an architectural element in a bigger application architecture can play the role of a communication mechanism, because you send the transactions into the network, they get broadcast over the network, can be used as a storage, data storage element, because this data is immutably stored in the blockchain data structure. It can be used as a computation mechanism. And then, because it plays such an outstanding role in our book, we added as a fourth category, it can be used as an asset control and management mechanism. Asset control and management. So for fungible assets like money, where you don't care which $10 bill you have, you care about how many $10 bills you have. That's a fungible asset, and you can use it for that. but also for non-fungible assets like your bicycle, your laptop computer, etc. These are the functions it can provide in an architecture. And in terms of non-functional properties, we have strengths in immutability, non-repudiation, etc., etc. We have weaknesses, or you know, things that you need to address specifically, like confidentiality and scalability, that require some more attention in terms of how you can achieve them on a blockchain system. It's not impossible, and there's a lot of work going into achieving all of overcoming all of the limitations. But actually, it's not clear theoretically, like from a theoretical computer science perspective, it's not clear whether all of these limitations can be overcome at the same time.
Okay.
Well, how do you then go about and design and build an application? So first, take a good hard look at whether you need a blockchain, or whether it offers significant benefits. The Zaatari refugee camp, they could have done without a blockchain, but by using a blockchain, they say they saved 98% of the fees. That's pretty good, because if I donate money to the UN for helping refugees, I don't want to have that go into fees. I want that to help the people buy rice and whatever. So it can offer significant benefits even if you don't strictly need it. And then you can follow one of the flow charts that guide you in deciding when to consider using blockchain, when to rather consider a traditional database. There's one in our book. There's numerous versions out there by now. And if you then decided that you want to design a system based on blockchain, then comes part two of the design process, which is also described in our book, that helps you answer the questions in a meaningful order. So you typically want to start with, how do you decentralize trust? Is it needed, or can you do it? And when you answer that question, which then has implications on like which blockchain platform do you use, to whom do you open the blockchain platform, etc., etc. Then typically the next question is, what do you put on-chain and what do you keep off-chain in terms of data, communication, storage, etc., etc. And there are a few more questions like that. The last one, sometimes overlooked, right? If I'm using blockchain to decentralize trust and to get around needing a trusted authority, and then I have a consortium with 50 different companies, and everybody uses the same cloud platform to run their blockchain, then you do have a centralized trusted authority, namely the provider of that cloud platform, which is very easy to get around by having some of the people using one cloud platform and some using the other. But, yeah.
Okay, yeah, but you need to be careful.
You need to keep quite a few things in mind when doing that. And then, of course, last but not least, look for a good ecosystem, good tooling like IDEs, etc., and the availability of libraries, and pay good attention to security practices when writing your code.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds a lot of decisions you need to make before you do something.
Well, I mean, you're already doing something when you're designing the application architecture, and when you're looking at all the properties and you know, requirements. Elicitation is just tremendously useful, regardless of what system you build, what platform you build your system on later on. Having a really good understanding of the requirements and then the implications on your architecture from these architecturally significant requirements, etc.
That sounds...
And if it sounds a bit overwhelming, can always buy our book and...
Yes, I will link the link to the book in the show notes, so
yes,
everyone can check it out.
Certainly.
and also to your profile. So I guess we will end on this note, and thank you for interview, and good luck in research and further applications.
Yes, thank you very much, Anton, for the nice interview and for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening for this two-part interview with Ingo Weber. In case you have questions, comments, or requests, send it to our Twitter account at asideofdata or send us direct email to the asideofdata@protonmail.com. Thank you for listening for these episodes.